Good evening, everybody. I'm Mike Birbiglia. I'm not sure you know me, but you might recognize me from I was the guest host of the Moth podcast when Dan Kennedy went on summer vacation. And I think that would be the only place. I actually want to start by just, I had kind of a Moth moment this week that I was telling Catherine Burns, the artistic director of the Moth, who's here tonight. I was telling her that I was very excited because I was on tour. I just finished up this weekend in Milwaukee, and I was at a Potbelly sandwich shop. Yeah, it's fitting to my physique and what I aspire to. And there was as a comedian, kind of the worst thing that people can say to you is they go, "You're a comedian, tell us a joke." It's a lose-lose situation. And this guy at Potbelly Sandwiches goes, "Hey, you're Mike Birbiglia. Tell me a Moth story." And I was so excited, you know, because for years I've been a part of the Moth since 2003, and I've always described the Moth to people as a New York City's best-kept secret, and now I can't say that anymore, because the Moth is it's very popular. It's so popular that even douchebags like it. And that's a real mark of success. I have the hosting duties with my co-host Jonathan Ames this evening, who you might know from his brilliant novels and his show Bored to Death. Jonathan Ames will be played this evening in an unusual move for him by Jonathan Ames. And I just want to start by saying some stuff that's on his card. A big story this year is the Moth Radio Hour, like our radio show. There, yeah, we can clap intermittently. That's fine. I'll continue. Like our radio show, the clip that you just heard was produced by Jay Allison. We've had 3 seasons, and we've already... yeah, there you go. Keep clapping. I don't really know what the appropriate times to clap are, but I won't object to your clapping. We've had 3 seasons, and we've already been played in over 200 markets, which for lay people means towns. It's been one of the biggest launches in public radio history. We'd like to thank our distributor, PRX, who are here tonight. I see some arms flying, so I'm guessing they are involved, and some hooting from over there. Figured you guys would have better seats, but as you leave, each of you will receive a gift bag, and in each bag you will find a CD of a recent radio hour. Listen and let us know what you think, preferably the positive stuff, because that's really all we want to hear. And also, you guys should know, if you don't know this already, there are items that are for auction. These are some of the most exciting auction items. I go to a lot of events like this, like 2 a year, and that is by far the best auction that items. I mean, unbelievable stuff. I mean, people really care about the Moth. They really do. Tickets to Broadway shows, and you know, Jonathan volunteered to have someone come on the set of Bored to Death, and lunches with people, you know, Adam Gopnik, who's right here, Adam Gopnik, everyone, Lily Taylor, Malcolm Gladwell, which is, it's a 1-hour lunch, but the first 20 minutes are amazing. Is that okay? I had to check that joke with my wife before the show. Brian Greene will explain string theory to you over lunch, so that's something I will not bid on, because I think that even in the most simple terms I would not understand that. I did the lunch, actually, last year. I did a lunch with me, which was entirely boring for the person. I'm not sure they may have asked for a refund. And so this year, what I'm giving is tickets to my show and my book, and also I will have an email correspondence with you that is at least 5 emails long. Because as the way I feel is that my personality is best expressed through revisions. I do very well over email. And it's much less awkward than having lunch with a stranger who flew in from Ohio. This is a very exciting part of the night. This is the slam portion of the evening. The Moth Story Slams are storytelling competitions. They're open to anyone with a 5-minute story to tell. Storytellers in New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Detroit prepare stories on a theme. They put their names in a hat, and the first 10 names picked get to share their stories, which are judged by the audience. And the winners of these contests compete to be the Grand Slam champion. And I'd like to thank the regular hosts of the Story Slams, Dan Kennedy, Sarah Barron, and Ophira Eisenberg. Give them a big round of applause. Tonight, the winners of the last 8 Grand Slams are with us. They're going to come on stage right now to perform 1-minute recaps. That's right, 1-minute recaps. There's nothing like a 1-minute story that really gets across. Okay, now I'm sounding negative again, but I mean that in a very affectionate way. So please give a big, big, big warm welcome to the Moth's last 8 Grand Slam champions, Brad Lawrence, Liz Spector, Moran Cerf, Kathleen Miller, Courtney Belanti, Madison Perry. That's him. No, him. No, he, me behind you. Him. Yeah, Madison Perry, and then you're the surprise guest. I'm so glad you fucked that up, because I fucked up the whole beginning part. This is my co-host, Jonathan Ames, everybody. He will be sitting in and reading for Stephen C. James, who was unable to be here tonight, and so now he has a stand-in. Jonathan Ames, and here we go.
I often thought of my stepfather as the angry potato, because he was the shape and color of a potato, and he was angry. Then, when I was 6 years old, he decided he was going to roughhouse with me for the very first time. No one had ever roughhoused with me before. Shouted threats of violence laced with creative cursing, certainly. Play fighting, no. So when he began laughing maniacally and tickling me, I thought the man had snapped. I thought the apocalypse he had been threatening for so long was finally upon us. So I did what anyone would do when faced with the end of their very short life. I broke his nose with the spine of a National Geographic magazine. From then on, there would be no more play fighting with the angry potato. From then on, all the fighting would be for real.
I was a teacher in the South Bronx, and I loved it. And I loved it because I decided that the way for me to be good at it was to get really close with my students. I would make the distance between their home lives and their school lives this big. I went to their houses. I went to their birthday parties. If they forgot their homework, I brought it home to them after school. And in particular, I got really close with my favorite crazy schizophrenic girl named Jacqueline. And she would introduce herself to people by saying, "Hello, my name is Jacqueline, but you can call me Susie." So Jacqueline wasn't allowed to go on field trips because of her behavior, but on the last field trip of the year to Central Park, she begged me and begged me to go, and I thought, it's just the park, how bad could it be? So I relented. That was an error. As soon as we get on the subway, she's bopping kids in the head. She's opening the subway door, sticking her neck out, trying to let it close on it. She gets to the sandbox in the park. She steals a truck from a toddler and scoops sand up and throws it in his face. Midway through the day, I can't find her. She's found herself the Paris Hilton of Central Park and is sitting on her towel, gooping Kiehl sunscreen all over her body, taking a bath in it. And when it's time to go back to the Bronx, my kids are gathering their stuff. We're missing a pair of sneakers. All hands point to Jacqueline as the thief. I turn towards her, and she goes, "Why are you always accusing me?" and runs out of the park, barefoot, into Midtown Manhattan. And as I'm chasing after her, running block after block through the city streets, running for my life and my job, thinking, if I catch you, I am going to fuck you up, I realize that maybe we have gotten a little too close.
I was convinced that Carrie was the one. Who else would take me to plays I hated just to hear me rant? And how would it ever feel so good to make someone else laugh? But I had a girlfriend. And then, 3 years on, when we're both finally single and everything I want is right there in front of me, I hesitated. And that was when I lost her. Carrie was gone. There would be no second chances. And this haunted me for years. Through every subsequent breakup and any bout of loneliness, I was convinced that I would always be alone because I had let the one, my soulmate, get away. Then I grew up, fell in love, and got married. And that was when I realized that the one who gets away is not the one that they're trying to get away. Because true love is about being allowed to make mistakes. Anything else is just a crush.
So 10 years ago, I used to break into banks to make a living. I would steal anything between $1,000 to $10,000 a week, and then I would give it back. I was a hacker. We would steal money, we would go to the board of directors, tell them how we did it, and then we asked them to get a portion of the money. In return, we would tell them how to secure their banks better. And I did it week by week, until one day, one of my teammates, Tammy, who was a 35-year-old woman who just broke up with her boyfriend after 9 years because she wanted to have a baby and he did not want, came to me and said, "I read the fine print of the contract, and it says that we can actually physically rob the bank. We are allowed to actually go into the bank and rob the bank ourselves. And we should do that." And she used two arguments. One was, "You only live once." And the other one was, "Please, please, 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 let's rob the bank." Which made me say, "Sure, let's do that." So we spent a weekend, three of us, learning how to break into banks. And I should tell you that there is no guidebook called Breaking into Banks for Dummies. So we had to come up with our own methods. And we did it. We went on Monday morning to a bank in downtown and got into it and started robbing it the way you do. And I think I knew that things fall apart when Tammy was emptying the safe and coming back to me with a necklace, $100 million worth, and asking me, should we take it or not? While the other team member, Gal, was giving his phone number to the teller, asking her out after we had a debate whether she should not put a ski mask on us. So this was kind of a moment where I knew that things are falling apart. Thank you.
In the fourth grade, I was accepted into the Advanced and Gifted program, and I was convinced life was going to be all Doogie Howser at Harvard from here on out. As the only girl in a program for geniuses held inside of a trailer, I spent most of my year trying to win the approval of a dozen boys who were convinced that a double X chromosome always indicates a terminal diagnosis of stupid with cooties. Trying to be cool, I copied the crowd-pleasing move of the day, the practical joke. I slipped leftovers from our salt rock crystal experiment into four milks at lunch, not realizing that not all salts are edible. The boys really enjoyed the disgusted looks on the face of the drinkers and their recoils, and I was in. An hour later, I was in the principal's office. He was informing me that there were four boys in the hospital having their stomach pumped. They were near death. There could be manslaughter charges. I had always thought manslaughter had to involve a chainsaw. Little do I know, the boys are actually fine. Momentary tummy aches, then they went back to class. The principal is just trying to teach me a lesson. While I plan for my 10-year plan to include Shawshank, my mother arrives, goes to the office, meets with the principal, calls him out on his total BS, and then takes me out for ice cream and to see the Aristocats.
In high school, I find me a really nice Catholic boy to date, with a really normal family, and basically the exact opposite of my family, or maybe I should just say my father. He's one of those independent free thinker types, you know, the one who's always doing Tai Chi moves in the parking lot, even of my high school. So even though my dad and my boyfriend are polar opposites, I really want them to meet and like each other. So when he gives me a call and says, "Why don't you and your new boyfriend meet me and my new girlfriend at this hot tub place you rent by the hour?" And I say yes. And I know it's really odd, but I'm thinking anytime you meet my father, it's pretty much going to be odd. So we show up with our bathing suits on under our clothes, and we start to get dressed. And I hear the three words that seriously to this day kind of make me want to vomit. "You're wearing suits?" And I think, oh, shit. And, you know, most people can go their whole lives without seeing their parents naked, and if they aren't fortunate enough to catch a glimpse, you pray it's just that, a glimpse. Well, me and my boyfriend saw it all that night, and none of it was good. But they say when two people live through a traumatic experience, and it was traumatic, that it'll bring them closer, and that must be true. We've been married 11 years now.
I'm going to read the one-minute story by a Grand Slam winner named Stephen James. Is that the correct name? Stephen James? Oh, well, there's Stephen. Okay. And so I didn't write this, but I identify with it strongly. Okay. After a budget cut at work, I was instantly fired as English teacher and rehired as the drama teacher, a job for which I was underqualified. I was taking over for a woman that was beloved and honored to the point that taking over for her was like finding out I was replacing Jesus. So I dove in completely and completely lost my own identity. I began slowly feeling with resentment and rage as I spent every weekend doing things like shopping for little girls' dresses and building sets so shoddily constructed that Child Protective Services probably should have been involved. My seething was contagious. The night of our spring show, a fight broke out between two girls in a place strictly off limits to me, the girls' dressing room. Despite my inspirational speech to the cast to end the fight, another girl came to me moments later saying, "This fucking play is fucking bullshit, and I'm going home, fucking home, right fucking now." Fortunately, she didn't go home, and the show was fine because there is very little difference between the world's best middle school play and the world's worst middle school play.
In America, if you do anything, even something as small as a 5K fun run, you have to register and pay $50 and sign a waiver that says you could die from jogging. In Spain, to do the running of the bulls, at which you run with live bulls, you step through a fence. That's it. We warn people that bags of peanuts may contain peanuts. They do nothing. So I stepped through the fence, and I stood with the other runners, and a rocket went off in the sky, signaling they'd let the bulls go. And I tensed up and I waited, and around the corner came this wave of people, this surge of white and red, followed by six gigantic bulls. And I started sprinting as hard as I could, and people were pushing me and saying, go, and vamanos, and toros, and elbows were flying, and someone fell down beside me, and I wanted to help him, but I thought, no, leave him, he's already dead. And I kept running all the way to the arena.
Thanks again to all the Grand Slam champions, Brad Marriance, Elizabeth Spector, Oran Cerf, Kathleen Miller, Courtney Belanti, Stephen C. James, read by Jonathan Ames, Madison Perry.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming your co-host for the evening, Jonathan Ames.
I'm Jonathan. I'm your co-host with Mike tonight. And before I start, I just want to say that the room looks beautiful. It's so nice to be in a space that's, it's almost like being in nature in here. It's so kind of majestic in a way. Yeah, I mean, for an interior space. I mean, it was built for money, but we can forget about that. It's a former bank, and we can be happy to be here around something a little bit kinder, which is storytelling. And all of you look very beautiful, and the men look all right. And... Okay, so my first thing as co-host is I have to read again, not something as interesting as the story I just read, but I'm going to read this, and it's about the Moth Shop Scholarship. I mean, it is interesting, but yeah, I mean, just not as many jokes, perhaps, but because it's very important. All right. The Moth Shop Community Series offers storytelling workshops free of charge to high school students and adults in underserved communities. Each program begins with a live moth show. Moth story coaches then spend 10 weeks coaching the students' stories, and the program ends with students telling their crafted stories in front of their classmates and communities. A handful of the best storytellers are asked to tell their stories on the moth's main stage. Every year, one exemplary high school student storyteller is selected to receive a $5,000 college scholarship. This year's scholarship was donated by the Stephanie and Simon Bergson Foundation. The award goes to a young lady named Deborah Allen Carr. Deborah Allen Carr graduated from a moth shop workshop at Bronx Prep, and she joined the lineup at the Moth's annual New York Stories show at City Winery, where she told her story to a sold-out crowd of over 300 people. She now travels all over the five boroughs as a moth shop intro storyteller and peer story coach. And she's just graduated from the Advanced Moth Shop Storytelling Workshop. Here's a clip from Deborah's main stage story.
I was 5 years old, and it was my first time being at a summer camp, and it was my first time being at a museum. And then I hear group switch. I don't see any more children any longer, and I don't hear any more laughing, so I'm just standing there. Okay, I'm lost now. And then I remember the main office, which I spotted when we first came in. The office man asked me if I was lost, and I said, yes, I am. And he asked me if I knew my number, and I said, yes, I do. 718-590-4745. And he's looking at me, he's like, what? The way I learned my number was by singing it. And my mom had always prepared me with the tools for emergencies. And it wasn't long until I heard my mom, my hero, screaming through the echoing hallways, where's my baby? Y'all lucky she know her number. Where is she? She's in the main office? All right. It was just steam coming off of her skin like it was natural, and then the choo-choo smoke was coming out her ears, and I was just like, ooh. Flash forward to years after that. I'm 17 now, I'm a senior. Just before we got on the Cross Bronx Expressway, my mom let me have, she gave it to me. She said, Deborah, you are slacking. I don't know what kind of Ivy League college is going to want someone who has bad attendance, terrible grades, and who doesn't care about school anymore. You're losing your mind and you're losing yourself. She didn't do it to make me not feel special. She told me that because I am special. And what she was telling me was that I needed to grow up. And I'm going away next year. I'm not going to be able to sing a number to somebody and then mommy's there. I had to take responsibility for myself because it all depended on me, what decisions I had to make.
Good evening. I'm better at making lists than making speeches, so here goes. One, I am so glad that Mr. George Dawes Green moved to New York. Yeah. Two, the Moth has blessed me so much. I included in my college essays how awesome the organization is and how being a part of it has been a light in my life. Three, I plan on studying both neonatal nursing and environmental chemistry and research. This wonderful scholarship will definitely make my college transition easier and my life easier financially. Four, I would like to give a huge thanks to the Stephanie and Simon Bergson Foundation for donating the scholarship and all the Moth staff for awarding me the scholarship. And a special thanks to Sarah Jennis, Maggie Sino, Kate Erickson, Sandra Struthers, Larry Rosen, Peter, Stacy Seely, Dr. Simona Tate, Sam Rongso, and of course, my mommy. Thank you.
Deborah Allen Carr. So now what we're going to do is we're going to have two stories, but before we have the stories, I'm just curious, how many people here know why the Moth is called the Moth? Just raise your hand, you don't have to, or you could clap, that's okay, the lady in the front, very eager, that's very nice. No, I don't want to point you out, I'm nervous. So if you could raise your hand if you know why the Moth is called the Moth. A few of you, a handful. Well, just to briefly explain, the fellow you just saw on screen, George Dawes Green, is the founder of the Moth. And when he was a small boy growing up in Georgia, I imagine they had TV, but maybe it was so hot that they wouldn't stay inside to watch TV, so they would gather on his porch, and people would tell stories, and the moths would move up towards the light, and he would look at the moths, and he would remember these stories, and it was kind of his own sort of rosebud moment. I've subsequently learned that the reason why moths go to the light, moths use moonlight to gather and then to copulate. They follow the moonlight and then they copulate. So when you see a moth going at the light, it's actually a lover who's lost his way or her way. It's very sad, actually. So it's good that the moth has tragedy as an underpinning of sorts. But anyway, so then George came to New York and was tolerating numerous dull cocktail parties, horrible breath coming at him all the time. And he thought, I want storytelling. I want what I had in Georgia. And so he thought of those moths, and he thought of being a little boy and his own, as I said, Rosebud Orson Welles thing with moths. And so he created this incredible storytelling organization, The Moth. So let's hear it for George Dawes Green. And now if John Spurney could come to the stage. He is the Moth's musician and timekeeper. Many of you have been to the Moth before. Probably the great invention of the Moth is that every storyteller has about 10 minutes to tell their story. And at the 10-minute mark, this gentleman will make a little noise, if you want to do that now. Yeah, very subtle, kind of lyrical. But then if the storyteller gets lost in some kind of narcissistic vapor of their own, which I can imagine happening, and they're going on too long, like if you've attended a reading at a Barnes & Noble and an author is just going on and you're just, all your goodwill has gone off around the 15-minute mark, and this person you formerly admired, you're now, you know, feeling negatively towards, it doesn't end. But at the Moth, that doesn't happen, because at the 11-minute mark, he'll begin to strum more vigorously. You could do a little of that. Okay, maybe not that vigorously. But anyway, so that gives the storyteller time that they have to wind down. So this way, you're not in codependent hell. You know, it's going to come to an end, and usually a nice end. And so this is his function, and it's a great invention of the Moth that you're here.
I'm, uh, I'm proud to bring to the stage one of my favorite storytellers and authors as well. And we just did the Moth main stage show at Cooper Union recently, and we had a great time. Please give a big warm welcome to Adam Gopnik, everybody. Adam Gopnik.
Thank you. Dying mothers, giving up Catholicism. What do I have to tell you about? The story I want to tell you tonight is actually sort of dedicated to a couple of people. One is to my wonderful daughter, Olivia, who's sitting with me tonight, who's 11 years old and a very grown-up and beautiful girl. And she's given me permission to tell this story, though she's policing it and is the fact-checking department as well. And the other person is the special honoree tonight, Calvin Trillin, because it was Trillin, really, who back in the 1970s wrote all of these wonderful pieces about family life in New York that convinced all of us in Milwaukee and New Mexico and in Canada, in my case, that New York would be a wonderful place to come and make a family, raise a family. And so we all came, and we ruined the city by our arrival as we all poured in, and Trillin was the magnet who drew us. We came, and then we left. My wife and I left New York for several years. We lived abroad. We lived in France. And we decided we would come home just 10 years ago, in the year 2000. For a lot of reasons, but essentially because we wanted to see our children grow up here in New York City. We wanted them to have not the experience that kids have growing up in Paris, where every child at 4:30 when school is finished looks like a Democrat. They look completely beaten and depressed and kind of dog-eared and enormous circles under their eyes, and they've been beaten and abused for the last 9 hours, and they have no idea how to respond to the force of unappeasable authority at every moment. We wanted them to have that kind of light-footed, spring-hearted sense of ownership that New York children seem to us to have. So we came back to be in New York so that they would have a childhood in New York, so that they would be able to be part of New York. And then, of course, we had just come back when greatest tragedy in the city's history happened, and a long shadow spread out over every life, and I think maybe particularly over the lives of parents with small children, as we wondered if we should stay in New York, if New York was the right place for us to be and the right place really for us to bring up our children. And it was just about at that moment when we were all full of doubt, as I suspect many of you were as well, and my wife, Martha, would put on my pillow night after night brochures from real estate in Connecticut and houses in New Jersey and even things clipped from the paper about the farthest reaches of Brooklyn. It was just at about that time that my daughter Olivia, who was 3 then, told us that she had an imaginary friend and that this imaginary friend's name was Charlie Ravioli. And at first, Charlie Ravioli seemed like a terrifically attractive Manhattan kind of character. He lived at the corner of Lexington and Madison, which seemed like a great neighborhood. And he lived, Olivia explained, on grilled chicken and water, sort of like a fashion model or an imaginary friend. And it was a great New York diet. We knew a lot of people who lived on exactly that. But then something a little disturbing or a little concerning began to happen. Olivia would be on her cell phone. You know, we gave her one of those toy cell phones that they had then, and she would be talking on it, and we would hear her say, "Hello, Ravioli? Ravioli? Okay, call me when you get in." And she would hang it up, and she would turn to us and say, "I always get his machine." And we realized that she had invented an imaginary friend who was always too busy to play with her. She had an invisible playmate whose salient characteristic was that he was too busy to play. And she would come every night to the table at dinner, and everyone would recite the things that had happened through the day, and we'd turn to Olivia, and she'd say, "Oh, I bumped into Charlie Ravioli today." We grabbed a cappuccino, but then he had to run. Or she'd say, I bumped into Charlie Ravioli today. She would say, we got into a taxi, but then he had a meeting, so he had to go. Turned out Charlie was working in television in those years. That's how Olivia explained it. But she actually would say he's working on a television, and we can never figure out if he was a talk show host, sort of like Charlie Rose, or if he was a guy in the electronics business with a little repair shop someplace in Queens. But that was what Ravioli did, and he was always too busy to play with her. Now, I should explain, of course, that Olivia, at that moment in her life, had no life where she was bumping into people, had no life where she was grabbing cappuccinos. She was simply kind of expressing and imitating the world that she heard all around her, and particularly that she heard from her mother every night when we would come to the table, and I would say to her mother, how was your day? And her mother would say, oh, you know, it was one of those days, you know, I bumped into Meg downtown and we grabbed a coffee, but then I had a cell phone message from Emily, but we couldn't connect, so we came back uptown, and, you know, on and on and on, a whole history of miscommunication that had enveloped 8 hours. And Olivia was taking that in. She had one person in her life who was out there in the world, her older brother Luke, was exactly 5 years older than she is, to the day, which tells you more than you really want to know. And every day, at the end of the day, they would sit down together for cookies and milk when Luke came back from school after Olivia had spent a day at the Central Park Zoo taking naps, doing the things that three-year-olds do. And she would say, Luca, how was your day? And he would say, okay. Luke, did the teacher like your essay? Yeah, I guess. Luke, what did you have for lunch? A sandwich, I guess. Luke, how was my day? The basic rhythm of man and woman gets set at about the ages of 7 and 2 and never alters throughout a lifetime. Well, Charlie Ravioli seemed to us like such a strange character that I decided I would call. I have five sisters. When the Moths would come on, they all have PhDs. They all teach in universities somewhere or other. When the Moths used to come onto our porch, they would dissect them and figure out exactly what genus that they belonged to. And one of my sisters is a developmental psychologist out in Berkeley. And I called her up because it seemed a little strange to me to have an imaginary friend who was always too busy to play with you. And I wondered if this was like something that came up a lot in the psychological literature. So I called her and said, listen, my daughter, you know, Olivia, has got this imaginary friend, but she's always trying to connect with him, never can, always too busy to play with her. And she said, oh, that's completely normal. That's completely normal because children make their imaginary friends out of whatever experience they have at hand. If they're living on mountaintops, they have imaginary friends who are made of clouds. If they live by the seashore, their imaginary friends are waves. So what could be more normal than that her imaginary friend growing up in Manhattan would be always too busy, would be a creature of interrupted occasions, of constantly occluded connections. Makes perfect sense. The kids understand that these imaginary friends are fictional. You have absolutely nothing to worry about. So I told my wife that, and I said, we have nothing to worry about. Completely normal. Every child in New York has a busy imaginary friend. So it seemed that this was going to be okay. But then a new character arrived in the story. We would listen to Olivia talking on her little cell phone, and we heard her talking to someone called Lori. Someone called Lori. She would say, hello, Lori, hello, is Ravioli there? No? Okay. And at first we thought, you see, that Lori was sort of the Linda Tripp of the whole Ravioli operation. That she was the person you spoke to when Ravioli was ignoring you, the big creep that he obviously was, and you sort of confided in Linda Tripp, and she was recording your conversations and so on. But then we listened more carefully, and we realized who Lori really was. Lori was Ravioli's assistant. She was Charlie Ravioli's assistant. She was the person on the phone who tells you, oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Ravioli is in a meeting. He'll try and get back to you as soon as he can. And Martha turned to me and said, this is wrong. This is really wrong. I don't know. I'm not a child psychologist, but I know that imaginary friends should not have assistants. they should not have agents. They should not have personal trainers. Imaginary friends should not have people. They should play with the child who imagined them. That is their role in life, not to be surrounded by an entourage who prevents the child who thought them up in the first place from ever actually playing with them. So I called my sister and said, Ravioli has an assistant who's answering his phone now. Would you describe this as normal? And she said, this never occurs in the psychological literature. And I said, oh, so you think we should look into it? And she said, no, I think you should move. But then something very strange, something very interesting began to happen. Olivia didn't seem to get any closer to Charlie Ravioli. She didn't seem to come any nearer to actually having the play dates and the good times with him that it seemed to us that she deserved. But every day she would report to us at the end of the day that she had gone out into the world in search of Charlie Ravioli, and something amazing had happened to her. She had gone out looking for Charlie Ravioli, and she had ended up in the zoo, and she had released all the animals from the zoo, and they had had a dance. She had gone out looking for Charlie Ravioli. She came home and told us one day, about a day, of course, when she spent it entirely inside watching Caillou on television and taking a nap. She had gone out in search of Charlie Ravioli on the streets of Manhattan, and the taxi driver had had a heart attack, and she'd gotten into the front seat of the taxi and driven through the city throughout the day. She'd gone looking for Charlie Ravioli downtown somewhere, and she had ended up telling jokes in a nightclub with a microphone. And we realized that Charlie Ravioli, for her, was truly the prince of the city. He was the prince of our disorder. He was the representative of the spirit of New York, which is always the spirit of attainment. It's always the spirit of the thing that lies before us. It's always the place that we haven't quite got to yet, but we'll get to someday. Ravioli wasn't, we realized, just an incarnation of the insane busyness and misconnections she saw around us. He was also her hero, her demigod, her fictional version of the endless possibilities in New York, which always lay just around the corner and on the other side of a cappuccino. And so in those years, when we were all asking ourselves, should we leave New York? Should we go out of New York? When I was being bombarded with real estate literature from Connecticut, where all writers go and become alcoholics and write bad autobiographical plays, I knew that we could stay in New York, because I understood that all we really wanted from this city, and I could say to my wife whenever she suggested that we leave, all we wanted was to go on bumping into Charlie Ravioli as long and as often as we possibly can. Thank you so much.
The Jonathan Adler Designed Moth Genius Award is going to go tonight to Calvin Marshall Trill and the great Calvin Marshall Trill. Bud is Bud Trillin, as we call him. Bud Marshall is an old family name, just not from his family. It's unclear where that comes from. Before I came here tonight, I called Bud on the telephone, and I like to call Bud quite a lot, and I like to talk to him because he's the only writer at the magazine that calls me El Jefe Supremo, which I appreciate very much. Most writers don't call you that at all. I called him because he has made thousands of speeches in honor of this, that, and the other thing for organizations like Amnesty International or the Moth. And he's done so much of this that his daughters have come to call him the Georgie Jessel of the nonprofit world. There are 8 people here old enough to know who Georgie Jessa was. Bud's advice to me tonight about introducing him was, I thought, really apt and very simple. He said, and I quote, "In these situations, it is always advisable to err on the side of effusive." He also said that if I was searching for an adjective, it was okay for me to use dashing, and so I will. I want to argue tonight that Bud Trillin is the baddest man in American letters. Thank you. In an eating contest of any kind, he can kick Emily Dickinson's ass. He is, by any estimation, the author of the finest novel ever written about parking in New York City. As a political poet, he has absolutely no parallel. The Nation magazine pays him in what Bud calls the high 2 figures for his verse, and during the 2008 election, he wrote many such lucrative poems. His Sarah Palin poem is called "On a Clear Day I Can See Vladivostok." His poem on John Edwards was called, this is great, "Yes, I know he's a mill worker's son, but there's Hollywood in that hair." And of John McCain, he penned the epic, "The Rhyme of the Ancient Candidate." As a teller of American stories, comic and serious, Bud Trillin is in very, very narrow and rare company. He is far more than the sum of his dim sum and his deadpan. He is a unique American voice who has told us much about American family, American stories, American lives, politics, race, the Kansas City of his boyhood, and the New York City that he loves so much. His award, unfortunately, comes at a time that is in the midst of the book tour of one of his bete noir, one of his least favorite characters, and that's George W. Bush. And so it's left to me to deflate the former president's sails by reading one of Bud's great lyric poems called "A President Who Listens to a Higher Authority." This is by Bud Trillin. "He can't remember one mistake. He'll stay on course till Hades freezes. How can he be so certain still? Because he's got the word from Jesus. In meetings of his White House staff, unquestioning commitment pleases, since human doubts mean nothing to a man who's got the word from Jesus. He treats his critics in the press as if they're yapping Pekingese. Reporters deal in mundane facts. The man has got the words from Jesus. He can't believe that you'd support the sort of man who eats French cheeses when you can vote to keep in place a man who's got the word from Jesus. Please welcome the great bard of lard, the baddest ass in American letters, my friend, Bud Trillin."
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I actually told David just something simple on the introduction, maybe not since Mark Twain, something like that. I want to make one correction about the parking novel, and I'm not here to boast. We believe it's the first parking novel ever written. And actually, there hasn't been a big rush to write parking novels since then. For those of you who think this is probably the first honor he's ever received and the only honor, I would like to say that in 1953, Southwest High School in Kansas City, I was voted 3rd most likely to succeed. Third most likely is sort of a failure. And I have given some awards myself. I played in a basketball game many years ago on Gansport Street, and we had an awards banquet, and it was sort of ad hoc awards banquet. You could give whatever awards you wanted. And I used to give the Richard Nixon Award for the most specious out-of-bounds argument. And I gave an award to Victor Novasky every year, most improved Jewish player. I'm very pleased to get this award. It's been a long time since the third most likely to succeed. And also, I'm very honored to be getting an award that some of the people who have gotten it previously have gotten. And this is a very nice company to be in. And I've always been interested in storytelling, and what I've done for The New Yorker over the last 45 or so years is basically telling stories in the way George talked about telling stories on the porch with the moth. We had the same thing in Kansas City, except the insect I remember was not the moth, but the chigger. Those of you who aren't from the South or the lower Midwest probably don't know about chiggers, but a chigger is a microscopic insect whose bite is, I had to actually invent a sort of metric for it, which is a millimos, which is the itching power of 1,000 mosquito bites. And the average chigger bite is about 8 millimoses, and it lasts just short of eternity. Amputation helps, but not always. And they're especially prevalent in the tall grass. And when I go home to Kansas City, people say, "How can you live in New York?" And I said, "There are no chiggers in New York." And they say, "Not even in the tall grass?" And there aren't any tall grass in New York. And I think that's why a lot of people from the Midwest are spread out around the world. I think standing on the Eiffel Tower and there's somebody from Fort Scott, Kansas, or Sedalia, Missouri next to you, and you think they're looking over Paris and say the City of Lights, what a sight. And what they're really thinking is, even if they got them over here, they couldn't get up this high, probably. So if I had founded this organization, and you're lucky I didn't found this organization, it would be called The Chigger. We would be at the Chigger Ball. But at the Moth Ball instead, and I'm grateful to be here and grateful for this award. Thank you.
So just to close out the night and to thank you all for coming, those of you who may have seen me perform over the years know I have a little bit, this shtick, it's called the Harry Call. It's a sound my friends and I, thank you, 8 of you for clapping. It's a sound my friends and I would make on the playground when being attacked by more normal children. It's kind of a cry for help. It's a story in a sound, in a sense. And so I'll do 3 Harry calls to send you into the night, to the auction, to the dancing. And not to be rude, but I adopt a position when doing the Harry call. And Mike is going to do the Harry call for the people that need American Sign Language for the hearing impaired, since we're co-hosts. And I won't use the mic because I don't know what will happen if I use the mic, and so I hope to project in a Shakespearean fashion. So here will be 3 Harry calls, and thank you for supporting the Moth, and have a beautiful evening after the Harry call. So 3 Harry calls. Okay.